From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. The nomination hearings of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court promised to be controversial. It seems the last few Supreme Court nominations have created something of a furor. Today, we take a historical look at the nomination process with an expert on the subject, law professor Walter Dellinger. Also today, education writer Edward Fiss tells us what we can do to improve our schools. It's the subject of his new book, Smart Schools, Smart Kids. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a couple of live shows before they even air. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Secretary General, Javier Perez de Cuellar, has had talks in Geneva with an Israeli delegation about the efforts to resolve the Middle East hostage problem. He said afterward that it might be naive to expect developments in the next few days. The secretary dealt with Uri Lubrani, the leader of the Israeli delegation. Christopher Powell filed this report from Geneva for the BBC.
Mr. Lubrani said his conversation with the Secretary General had been very good, adding that Israel's view of the problem of releasing hostages and prisoners of war had been conveyed and that contacts were going to continue. But it's clear that the Israelis are being very cautious. It had been suggested that as a show of goodwill, the Israeli delegation might have said it was willing to release a small number of the hundreds of Lebanese prisoners it's holding. But Mr. Lubrani repeated that Tel Aviv must first receive information about 7 missing Israeli servicemen.
We have made it abundantly clear that we are expecting a sign of life from these prisoners so that we can go and release them.
Mr. Lubrani said he was always optimistic, and he described the involvement of the Secretary General of the United Nations in the search for a solution to the problem as a good omen.
Christopher Powell in Geneva. Israel's deputy foreign minister said today that his government is prepared to make gestures for a prisoner exchange. Israeli officials haven't spelled out what a gesture might entail, but they've hinted that Israel may be willing to take a first step in freeing some of its Arab prisoners. Benjamin Netanyahu denied an Iranian report that Israel will free the kidnapped Shiite cleric Sheikh Abdul Karim Obeid by the weekend. A United Nations inspection team has found that Iraq was able to produce biological warfare agents and a limited number of biological weapons. Linda Fasula reports from the UN.
UN experts recently completed an inspection of an Iraqi facility suspected of having germ warfare capability. The team's leader, David Kelly, told reporters today that Iraq was capable of producing vast quantities of biological warfare agents, as well as limited numbers of biological weapons. While the team found no evidence of biological weapons, Kelly said he couldn't rule out the possibility that weapons had been manufactured there. The British scientist said the team was hindered in its inspections. The Iraqis had moved key buildings from the site before the experts arrived, and it had been damaged by Allied bombings during the Gulf War. Inspections of other suspected sites are planned. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street after a session of mixed trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 3 points to close at 3,005.37. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 196 million shares. This is NPR. An aerospace worker pleaded guilty today to attempted bombings and a bomb attack on federal tax offices in California. Dean Harvey Hicks claimed that he set the bombs in such a way as to minimize the risk of injury to people. A federal prosecutor said, however, that one bomb that Hicks planted in a truck at a Los Angeles IRS office could have leveled 2 city blocks if it had exploded. The FBI has said that Hicks was angry at the IRS for refusing him a deduction on an $8,000 donation that he made to a mail-order church. Nearly half of Colombia's 74-member Constituent Assembly may have received bribes from drug trafficker Pablo Escobar prior to a June vote that declared extradition unconstitutional. This allegation is said to be backed up by a videotaped record of one bribery session. Leslie Werpsa reports from Bogota.
Members of so-called self-defense groups have revealed a videotape in which a representative to the Constituent Assembly received a bribe from a man claiming to be a lawyer representing Medellin drug trafficker Pablo Escobar. The lawyer allegedly attempted to give bribes of over $3,000 to 36 Assembly members, encouraging them to vote in favor of a ban on extradition. 2 days after the June vote, Escobar surrendered to Colombian authorities under the government's plea bargaining program. President Cesar Gaviria has reportedly known about the tape for weeks. Colombia's new constitution went into effect on July 4th, prohibiting extradition of Colombian-born citizens to other countries to face trial. Meanwhile, a government report says the drug rings are getting into heroin production. The police destroyed 2,000 acres of opium poppies this week in southern Colombia. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Wurpsa in Bogota.
The nation's largest minority-owned newspaper announced today that it will stay in business. Robert Maynard, the owner, editor, and publisher of the Oakland Tribune, said that he's reached an agreement with the Gannett Company, which sold him the paper in 1983. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne. Immediately after Thurgood Marshall stepped down from the Supreme Court, the public debate on the confirmation process began. Next month, the Senate begins its part in the procedure when it holds hearings. We asked Walter Dellinger, a constitutional law professor at Duke University, to explain where the court has been going in the last few years and what he sees as its future direction. Dellinger thinks that when the Senate begins its hearings, it should look at its constitutional mandate more closely. He says it's time for the Senate to take a broader role than just checking the professional credentials of the nominee.
The Senate has taken the view that it can also take a candidate's philosophy into account, a candidate's nominee's ideology. But senators are somewhat hesitant to do that. They will variously describe their role as being allowed to vote no if they find a candidate is a dangerous radical, or if they find that he or she is outside the mainstream of legal thought. I think the framers of the Constitution contemplated the Senate not taking such a backseat to the president.
I wonder, though, how much of a backseat is it to be able to say yes or no? And certainly nominees have been rejected. Bork, of course, the most recent one.
It's true. The Senate has rejected the nomination of Judge Bork most dramatically and most recently. The Senate rejected the nomination of Justice A. Portis to be Chief Justice of the United States in 1969. And it rejected Judges Haynesworth and Carswell shortly thereafter. Nonetheless, if you talk to members of the Senate, you often hear them placing a strong burden on those who would oppose a nominee. Senators will say, well, I haven't yet seen a smoking gun. I'm not sure there's any strong disqualification that has emerged about this particular nominee at one time or another. When, in fact, the selection of Supreme Court justices is a matter that the framers thought required the concurrence of two branches of the government, just as is the passage of legislation. When the president vetoes legislation or signs it, the president doesn't defer to the Congress one bit, as far as I can see, whereas there's still a considerable amount of deference given by the Senate to the president.
How important do you think that that a member of the Supreme Court have judicial experience before sitting on the court?
Well, I'm not sure that is as important as we have very recently come to think of it. I took a look recently, Marty, at the biographies of the justices who decided the most important 20th century case, Brown versus the Board of Education, ending school segregation. That decision came down on May 17th, 1954, so I decided to take a look at that court and see how its biographies differed from those of the present court. And it was quite striking. Not a single justice on the court that decided Brown versus the Board of Education had ever spent a day as a judge.
What
did
they?
No prior judicial experience.
What had they been doing?
They'd been doing things that were too important in public life for them to give up to be lower court judges. On that court were three former United States senators, two former attorneys general, two former solicitor general of the United States, the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg war crimes trial, every single member of that court had been prominent in the public life of the nation before going on the court. You don't give up the governorship of California to go and be a lower court judge. Really starting particularly in 1981 with a series of nominations, the presidents have chosen people who are not generally known to the public.
What does this public life, this life outside the judiciary, then give a member of the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it is something that is sadly lacking for the present court. You don't need, certainly don't need nine members of the court who played major roles in public life. But when you have no one on the court, no one, as is the case presently, you have a court with no member who really understands how the national political process works. It's a court of logicians that seems sometimes out of touch with the reality of life. Justice Thurgood Marshall was the only member of the court who had played a prominent public role, and so now there's none. I think when you have a court, probably the first in our history, in which no member of the court ever served in Congress, I'm not sure they have a sense of how the political process works.
Do you think, though, that the Supreme Court should have a sense about how the political process works? Would that contaminate, do you think, some of their decisions?
I do think. I mean, I think Holmes, Justice Holmes was right when he said the life of the law has not been logic but experience. There's a deep truth in that, and if judges lack much in the way of experience and have only logic, they're missing some of the life of the law. And I'll give you an example. In the 1989 and 90 terms of the Supreme Court, the court reversed its interpretation of a number of points under the federal civil rights statutes from what earlier courts had done. By reinterpreting those acts, they threw that issue back in the political process at a time when our process has been dominated by Willie Horton ads and quota campaigns and sent Congress into something of a maelstrom. I think if there'd been a member of the court who had more experience in public life, he or she might have said, you know, we ought to hesitate before reexamining these precedents because we're going to set off a very, very, very deep and divisive political process over race if we do that. Everyone would agree, Marty, that when a court is deciding whether or not to maintain old precedents, to follow the doctrine of stare decisis, that inevitably involves an exercise of judgment. How important is the interest of stability in the old doctrine? So when you face questions like that, I think it's useful to have a court that has some experience in public life, or at least has some members that do.
Do you think then it's important for the court, the Supreme Court, to wrestle then with the implications of their decisions on people and their allegiance to the Constitution? Should that be sort of an ongoing argument in the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's the court has to take account of what the impact of its decisions will be. I don't think that is necessarily in tension with its role as a faithful interpreter of the Constitution. So many of the Constitution's broad phrases, like the equal protection of the laws, really require an understanding of how certain measures impact upon people. For example, that we had a recent controversy over abortion counseling regulations, the so-called gag rule. If women who rely upon publicly funded family planning clinics cannot get advice about the possibility of abortion, where does that leave them? Well, some justices said, well, they can just simply go to a private doctor. Others thought that was quite unrealistic, that women who rely upon publicly financed clinics have access to private doctors. So in determining how great a burden a statute like that imposes upon an individual, it's important to have some sense of how people are affected by the work of the court.
Do you think it's a mistake to think of the Supreme Court only in terms of conservative or liberal?
Well, I think it probably is because the nature of the issues changes so greatly. It is very hard to predict the future and the kind of issues that are going to come up a decade from now. And we may not even know what liberal and conservative mean, and you know, in a different context. I do think there is some baseline aspect of judging that tends to continue in a particular judge over time, and that is whether a judge defers to the state, to the power of government, or not, or the extent to which a judge defers to the government. I think we have on the present court a number of justices who quite consistently over time accept the position of the government over that of the individual, and a dwindling number of justices who demand of the government a very compelling justification before the government interferes with an individual's liberty.
I'm speaking with Walter Dellinger. He's a professor of law at Duke University and specializes in constitutional law. We're talking about the selection process for the Supreme Court. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Dellinger, and he's a professor of law at Duke University. What do you think are the relevant, important questions that a nominee to the Supreme Court should be asked? What's in bounds? What's out of bounds?
All right. Marty, is one of the toughest issues that constitutional scholars are grappling with. Right off the bat, I'll tell you, it's easy to define what should be ruled out. I think it's not appropriate to ask a nominee, how would you rule in the case of, for example, Casey versus Planned Parenthood, which is on the court's docket, you know, number 90783 next term, in which the state statute requires a married woman to have to give notice to her husband before obtaining an abortion. How will you rule on that case? That seems to me is out of bounds, because, and the reason it's out of bounds is that the whole notion of an independent judiciary contemplates that a judge will make up his or her mind on the basis of the briefs and the arguments and the statutes that are before the court. And if you ask that kind of question in a confirmation hearing, it certainly has the appearance that you're extracting a political commitment from a judge about how he or she will vote on a particular case.
If you ask them about their judicial philosophy, and that's a very vague notion, I think, will that tell the Senate and then the public something about how this person will rule in the future? And is there a danger then of holding them accountable somehow?
I don't think there is a danger of holding them accountable if everyone understands that what you're trying to ascertain is simply what kind of person this man or woman is. Why not ask a nominee, how do you feel about abortion? How do you react to it? What do you think of the moral dilemmas involved? Or do you believe there are moral dilemmas involved? I don't think it is inappropriate to ask a nominee, to get very specific, do you believe that a woman has an important liberty interest in making her own reproductive decisions? Or do you think that a fertilized ovum or a fetus has constitutional status? Those are two different questions that you could ask a nominee. And a nominee ought to say, now, I may change my view, but here's what I think on those, and that doesn't tell you how I would vote in any particular case, but it gives you a sense of where I'm coming from.
Walter Dellinger is my guest, and he's a professor of law at Duke University and specializes in constitutional law. We're talking now about the upcoming hearings on Clarence Thomas' nomination to the Supreme Court. This, of course, is the seat which has been vacated recently by Justice Thurgood Marshall. When you look at the court's recent rulings, taken as a whole, from things like the gag rule regarding abortion counseling and federally funded planning clinics, about nude dancing not being protected by the First Amendment, about life term for drug possession, they ruled on a particular case, about fetal protection policies being illegal, where would you say the court is taking the country?
Well, I think the court is taking two fairly major steps. First, the court is deferring to the judgments of both the national government and state governments against individual claims, so that, for example, a majority of the court will now accept justifications by the state that many seem as relatively flimsy. For example, in the case in which a young man was given life sentence with no possibility of parole for a first offense of possessing cocaine. The state's argument as to why this was justified was that those people who are often the bottom level mules, couriers in the organization, not big drug kingpins, at least if you give them that kind of sentence, they might rat on higher-ups. Well, the state didn't have much in the way of proof that had actually happened, but the court was willing to accept the state's word for it. I mean, that's what you see across the board. I think within the national government, you have a court which is tilting strongly in the direction of executive authority, of favoring the power of the president over that of Congress. And a good example of that is in the area of the abortion counseling regulations. That prohibit doctors from discussing abortion with the pregnant women who are visiting federally funded planning centers. Congress never passed any such law. Those regulations were adopted by a single administrator in the waning days of the Reagan administration. And most observers thought the court would hold that those regulations simply went beyond the administrator's power, that nothing in the underlying law allowed an administrator to promulgate such regulations. And yet the court, surprisingly, by a 5-4 majority, first held that the administrator did have the power to promulgate those regulations, then upheld them against First Amendment challenge. And now Congress, there are substantial majorities in both houses of Congress to overturn them, but a presidential veto will likely keep them in place. So you see a process in which Congress is being cut out of the lawmaking process, and that's a large trend.
What issues are going to be coming before the Supreme Court later on this year? And I know that abortion is certainly making its way through the courts.
Well, we have it's going to be a very interesting term. The court is going to be deciding whether it's time to abandon desegregation remedies in the South in an important case from DeKalb County, Georgia, where the school system was once desegregated in 1969. It's been resegregated by population patterns, shifts, and the question is whether the school board has to correct that by using some busing. An important Operation Rescue case up. The Supreme Court is going to hear the very same issue that it's turned out to be very divisive recently in Wichita, Kansas. It's got a case called Jane Bray versus the Alexandria Women's Health Clinic, in which a federal court used a Civil War-era statute, the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, as a basis for awarding damages, money damages, against an Operation Rescue group that had closed down a women's health clinic in Alexandria, Virginia. And the Supreme Court is going to decide whether that older statute will actually support that judgment or not. And it's a very interesting case because the issue is whether interference with an abortion clinic is an activity which deprives women of equality rights. So the court is going to have to come very close to struggling with this issue in that case. Oh, I'll tell you the case that I think will be interesting to just about every American. The court has a seemingly trivial case that could be very important in the area of religious practices in the schools. The case is from Rhode Island. It's called Lee versus Weissman. And the issue is whether a public school may have a prayer in the form of a benediction at its graduation ceremony. And graduation prayers in public schools are a fighting issue, particularly throughout the South and the Midwest. And the lower courts held that under the court's school prayer decision, the government itself could not promote and sponsor a prayer. And what's at issue is if the Supreme Court allows graduation prayers, how far will they go? How far will they indicate they're going to go in admitting government-composed or government-sponsored prayers back into the public school system? So I think that's one that's going to cause a lot of interest.
You seem to be describing lots of old issues wearing new clothing.
Oh, that's a nice insight. It is certainly true. When you teach constitutional law, as I have for just about 20 years, what is interesting now is the court has gotten more conservative. People are bringing old issues back to the court that were once thought settled, so that I tend to be revisiting, as a constitutional law professor, issues that were decided and are now up to be decided all over again. I thought we were through with the school prayer issue, for example. I thought that would have been settled by the Supreme Court back in the early 1960s. But now it's back again, and all the old favorites seem to be coming back, just with different answers.
So you can kind of dust off some of your old notebooks, I guess.
Well, I guess I can give the same old exams. It's just that I'll change the correct answer changes.
Right. Is this an interesting time for a professor of law who specializes in the Constitution to live?
I suppose it is, though I must admit I was something of a child of the Warren Court. I clerked for Justice Hugo Black in 1968-69, which was the last year that Chief Justice Earl Warren served. And I guess I didn't think I would be teaching the undoing of some of those cases to the extent that I am 20 years later. So it's interesting. It makes for busy summers when Supreme Court justices retire. I would wish we could have one summer of peace and quiet without a confirmation process.
Well, I thank you very much, Walter Dellinger, for your time today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Walter Dellinger teaches constitutional law at Duke University. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. We all agree that the education system in this country is in trouble, but almost no one agrees on how to fix it. And many of the efforts of the past several years, things like higher teacher salaries and longer school hours, have met with only limited success. Education writer Edward Fith says it's time to stop trying to fix the old system and make a new one instead. Coming up, Edward Fith on creating schools that are ready for the 21st century. And two big rock stars have live specials on television this week. TV critic David Biancooley tells us which one's worth watching and which you should avoid. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There was more movement today in efforts to find a solution to the Middle Eastern hostage crisis. UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar met with an Israeli delegation. Both sides said that progress was made in the meeting, though they discouraged talk of an immediate settlement. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
Perez de Cuellar said today that it would be naive to expect a hostage settlement within a few days, but said his talks with the Israeli delegation made him hopeful that a settlement could still be achieved.
I think that what I have heard from the Israeli side has been extremely helpful to me. And then with their encouragement and with the encouragement of the captors, I will continue my efforts.
Reports in the Israeli media today suggested that Israel's negotiating team went to Geneva with a plan for a hostage swap. Israeli radio said the exchange would begin with the release of some Arab prisoners once Israel had proof of its servicemen's fate. That would trigger a wider release of Arab prisoners for the missing Israelis and the release of the Western hostages. But an Israeli Defense Ministry spokesman tonight denied that a release was in the works. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
Former hostage Edward Tracy is now in a VA hospital in Boston after an Air Force flight from Germany. Army doctors have said that Tracy, who was held prisoner for almost 5 years, is in good physical condition, but would probably need psychiatric counseling. It's the first time in 26 years that Tracy has been back in the United States, and making the trip with him were his three children. He had been in Beirut 10 years when he was kidnapped. In Poland, more than 1 million young people gathered to hear Pope John Paul II at a Vatican-sponsored Youth Day. The Pope, now on a 4-day visit to his home country, called on all young adults to live together peacefully. Gabrielle Glazer has more on the story.
Speaking on an outdoor altar at the Jasna Góra Monastery, the Pope told the youth that their future was at stake and called on them to create a civilization of love. The Pope addressed the crowd in 17 languages, including Russian, Lithuanian, and Ukrainian. He said it was necessary for all that has been separated in Europe to come together. The Pope's visit to Poland, his second this summer, is part of his mission to re-evangelize Europe. The pontiff, who inspired the Solidarity movement that toppled communism, is believed to fear a growing secularism in Eastern Europe now that it has democracy. Tomorrow, the Pope will say an Assumption Day Mass at the Shrine of the Black Madonna, Poland's most sacred icon. On Friday, he travels to Hungary for a 4-day trip. For National Public Radio, this is Gabrielle Glazer in Częstochowa.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 3 points to close at 3,005.37 on volume of some 196 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News. In Yugoslavia, federal officials trying to enforce a shaky ceasefire say that they are sending observers into Croatia. Last night, at least 6 people are said to have been killed in clashes between Serbian and Croatian forces. A spokesman for a state commission set up to oversee this latest ceasefire said a group of observers will move into troubled areas later on today and tomorrow. A spokesman said that their job is to see which side is violating a ceasefire. In Costa Rica, heavy rain has caused severe flooding along coastal areas. Tony Avgan reports from San Jose.
4 days of heavy tropical rains are causing rivers throughout Costa Rica's Caribbean coast to overflow. At least 3 people have drowned, dozens of communities are cut off by landslides, and over a dozen bridges have collapsed. Several of the bridges were recently constructed after a powerful earthquake devastated the same area in April. Waters in some rivers rose 25 feet, displacing thousands of people, and stranding hundreds on rooftops. The banana industry, which is concentrated on the Caribbean coast, has been devastated, with tens of thousands of acres of plantations destroyed. Water and sewage systems throughout the region have been washed away, and officials fear serious health problems when the floodwaters recede. Government officials say material losses will surpass the April earthquake. For National Public Radio, this is Tony Avergan in San Jose, Costa Rica.
Governor Richard Snelling of Vermont died overnight of an apparent heart attack. He was 64 years old. Aides say that Snelling had not been ill since March, when he was hospitalized one night with the flu. NBC News correspondent Douglas Kiker has died of an apparent heart attack. He was 61. Kiker had been at NBC for 25 years and covered the Vietnam War, Watergate, and conflicts in the Middle East and Northern Ireland. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 25 million American adults are functionally illiterate. Our scores on standardized tests are routinely lower than those of other industrialized nations. And dropout rates are as high as 50% in some urban areas. President Bush proclaimed that he would be the education president, and in April he unveiled an ambitious agenda for the public schools. The plan calls for allowing parents greater choice in selecting their children's schools, mobilizing a core of social services in the schools to address problems such as malnutrition and drug abuse, merit pay for excellent teachers, and the creation of experimental schools. Though his proposals are controversial, they have focused national attention on our education system. My guest, Edward Fisk, has written about education for 17 years for the New York Times. He has a new book called Smart Schools, Smart Kids: Why Do Some Schools Work? Fisk visited public schools across the country and found many innovative programs that he believes hold keys for improving our education system. And he feels it's imperative that these changes take place now.
Well, I think we're now in a situation both economically and socially where we have an enormous stake in improving our school system. We're now in a global economy, one which is very information-oriented, one which requires large numbers of people to be able to think. And this is a new situation, and we haven't been in it before. And for the first time, we have a national stake in the success of a system that has always been and will presumably continue to be highly decentralized. I think George Bush coming along and saying he wants to be the education president, I mean, whatever you think about whether he's doing that or not, has sensed that we now have an urgent national stake in improving our educational system.
Was there ever a golden age of education in this country where education did its job and did it well?
Well, you have to look at the situation and look at what schools were asked to do. Our public education system was created in the late 19th, early 20th century to serve a relatively simple industrial economy. It was an economy where you needed large numbers of people with enough facts, enough basic math and literacy skills, to go out and hold jobs that were not all that complicated, and many of which were made as repetitious as possible. And then you needed maybe 20-25% of the people who could think for the whole system. Now we're in a situation where everybody has to be able to think because jobs are much more complicated. In the earlier situation, you could serve the needs of the economy with a school system that was rigidly controlled from the top down, highly regulated, and where the basic method was for teaching was to have an adult stand up in front of a class and talk to a kid and then measure how much that kid could remember and feed back. If the goal, however, is to teach people to think, you simply can't do it with that kind of a system, and that's the problem. We have been trying to use a 19th century system to educate kids for the 21st century, and it just won't work.
Another practice which came out of this kind of factory model that you're describing, the factory model of the late 19th and early 20th century, were unions. And I'm wondering whether you think some of the rights won by teachers' unions have always been in the best interest of students.
Well, they've primarily been in the interest of teachers. But I think what we've got to do is stop trying to focus on a single group as part of the problem. Because unions have grown up because teachers were oppressed by administrators. There was, under the current system, there's no reason why teachers should trust administrators. We have a culture of schools where teachers are told to leave their brains at the door and just be quiet and take orders and use this textbook and use this curriculum. And principals are trained that they're the only ones who have the overview, the big picture to make decisions, so they shouldn't listen to teachers. But in a way, they are just as oppressed as teachers because they're forced into a situation where they have to operate in an authoritarian way, trying to get people who are unhappy about their situation to do things. Kids are oppressed, too, because they're told to spend long hours sitting and listening to somebody. You couldn't put adults through what you put kids through in the course of a school day. So everybody, in a way, is being squashed by this system because it's so rigid and authoritarian. And from the point of view of the kids, it's boring. From the point of view of the teachers, it's unfulfilling. And from the point of view of administrators, it's frustrating. So we have to change the whole culture, the whole climate, and the whole structure so that all of these various stakeholders are freed up to be more creative.
Edward Fisk is my guest, and he's a Montgomery Fellow at Dartmouth College and is also the author of a new book called Smart Schools, Smart Kids. You're talking then about literally caring about learning, that you care about what is going on in the classroom, you being the student.
Mm-hmm. Well, think about what we do to a kid. We take a kid, we say, sit down for 5 or 6 hours a day while somebody talks to you. You're not allowed to talk to anybody else. Al Shanker, the American Federation of Teachers, likes to say that in any work situation with adults, if something's going wrong, you're not getting something, the first thing your boss says is, well, have you asked anybody for help? Schools call that cheating. It's common sense in the real world. There was a school that I talk about in Smart Schools, Smart Kids, down in Louisville, where the principal wanted her teachers to feel about what it was like to be a kid in the school. So she had half a dozen teachers go and follow a kid's schedule. Three of them bailed out by noon. They said, I can't stand this. Nobody takes me seriously. It's not any way. You could never organize adults in a workplace the way we organize kids in school.
You're then talking about instituting a kind of cooperative learning environment. How does the teacher function in that? If they're not sitting or standing at the front of the class with lesson plans and tests and homework assignments, who are they? Where are they? What are they doing?
Now, the person that I focus on in Smart School, Smart Kids is Ted Sizer, who is a professor of education at Brown University. And his metaphor is that the teacher has to become the coach and the student the worker. Under the current method of organizing schools, the factory model, the teacher is the worker, and the kid is the bucket to be filled up, the victim, whatever. And the idea of education is to pour knowledge from the teacher's head into the kid's head and then have the kid give it back on a multiple choice test. What Ted Sizer comes along and says is that the teacher has to be the coach. The kid has to do the learning. You don't teach people to think by giving them information and seeing whether they can give it back to you. Kids have to generate information and manipulate it for themselves. That's the only way you learn to think. So the teacher can't do the thinking for the kid. So the teacher becomes the coach, any more than the coach puts the ball in the basket. The coach teaches the kids how to play the game and put the ball in the basket, but then the kids do it. So you're talking about no longer is the kid passive. He's active, and then the teacher is the enabler, the manager, the coach, whatever. And this can be very threatening because no longer is the teacher simply the authority figure. And a successful teacher will have kids learning things that the teacher doesn't even know. But that's what we've got to move toward.
Edward Fisk is my guest. His book is entitled Smart Schools, Smart Kids, Why Do Some Schools Work? We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Edward Fisk is my guest, and he's the author of a new book called Smart Schools, Smart Kids. I'm sure that you've had teachers tell you that too much of their time is taken up maintaining order, that they have to be authoritarian in order to keep students from erupting into chaos. Does somehow refocusing, reshifting the sort of authority and who has the information and who doesn't, is that going to take care of discipline problems?
It's not going to solve discipline problems any more than any single element will. But if you create the way schools are structured now, being bored is probably the most intelligent response you can have. And so you're going to have boredom, and so you're going to have discipline problems. If, however, you can restructure it so the teachers are empowered to think up creative exercises for the kids to do, and where the kids become actively involved in their learning, either maybe making use of technology, maybe working in groups, there are lots of ways you can do it. And I talk about schools that do this in the book. Then you've got kids, learning becomes a positive experience, and you're going to have fewer discipline problems.
I would think, too, that some teachers would just roll their eyes like, oh, here's another fad that someone in academia has thought up for me.
Yeah, exactly it. I've outlasted teaching machines, cooperative learning, you know it, you know, whatever. I'll outlast this one. But this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that the situation is not business as usual. We as a country are now in the position where we either improve our educational system drastically, and that means a total transformation of the way we organize it, or we become a second-class country economically and a socially polarized society. The choice is that simple.
You say that learning in American schools is a function of time, and certainly the distinct periods of the day, the concept of we have 3 weeks to cover this section on space exploration, and certainly the summer vacation, that whole issue. Do we really need to then rethink the kind of passage and the use of time within the school year?
Yeah. One of the characteristics of the factory model factory is that time is fixed and production varies. A factory operates on, an 8-hour shift, and management tries to run as many cars or refrigerators down the assembly line as possible. Labor tries to slow it up. The one thing that never changes is that 8-hour shift. Schools borrowed that same model. Time is fixed and learning varies. So the teacher talks for 43 minutes, and some kids will remember most of what she says. Others won't remember anything. Most kids will be somewhere in between. The one thing that never changes is the 43-minute period or the 6 periods a day or whatever or the 9-month school year. Time is fixed, and we tolerate wide divergences in the amount of learning that kids do. Another way of doing this is to do what industry is doing with things like quality circles. Say, here's our production goals, or in the case of schools, here's the level of learning which we're going to get everybody to. If kids then need more time to do that, give it to them. But instead of saying time is fixed and tolerating varying learning, we're going to say everybody's going to learn to think at this level, and whatever we have to do to the structure, you know, combine periods, longer days, shorter days, whatever, we'll do. Because now time is a function of learning, not the other way around.
When you talk about restructuring the system, is that going to cost money? Are taxpayers going to have to pay more for this new kind of education?
Well, when we talk about a restructured system, there are certain things that cost more and some savings. You talked before about how radical a change it is. We're talking about the cultural revolution of a major $200 billion a year industry. That's going to take retraining. And so there are significant training costs involved. We have to train teachers to start thinking and offering ideas. We have to train principals to tolerate teachers taking some responsibility. We have to train principals to be more open to parents. We have to train parents about how you take part in governing schools and so forth. So there are big training costs. On the other hand, if you're getting out of the regulation business, under a restructured system, the goal of leadership is to set objectives, to get out of the regulation business and into the service business to help the people who are actually out there in the classroom delivering the services, and then to measure results. So you don't need a whole lot of people in the middle, that middle-level bureaucracy, whose sole role is to pass instructions down from top to bottom and report back up from bottom to top as to whether they're being obeyed or not. And that's where your opposition is going to come from. That's where it is in the opposition is in corporations that have restructured. That's where the opposition's coming in the Soviet Union, where it's called perestroika.
One of the hallmarks of a bureaucracy is that self-preservation takes precedence over innovation.
Mm-hmm. Of course. And no institution changes without outside pressure. And schools are not the same as any other institution. It's going to take outside pressure. It's going to take pressure from the top, political leaders saying, we as a country, if we're going to be competitive, have to have a better school system. And it's going to take people at the bottom sensing that if their kids aren't educated better than the current system is educating them, that their kids are not going to be employable in the 21st century. Also, we've got the problem, the social problem, that we're moving toward a polarized society economically, top 30% and the bottom 70%. That gap widened in the 80s. And we're moving toward an educationally polarized society as well. And we simply can't afford that. It's a ticking social time bomb.
Edward Fiske, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Edward Fiske's book is called Smart Schools, Smart Kids. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. We'll have an update on the hostage release negotiations with a background report on Sheikh Obeid, the cleric kidnapped by the Israelis. Robert Siegel talks with an FBI investigator about cases of multiple slayings. Among other things, he explains that it's not against the law to be missing in this country. Five people have been killed in Yugoslavia in violation of the ceasefire there in the fighting between Croatians and Serbian rebels. And I'll talk with an official of the Serbian Republic who explains that, in his view, the Serbian rebels are the ones who are fighting for true democracy in Yugoslavia.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. Normally, a TV critic can't review live TV programs in advance, but critic David Bianculli doesn't do anything normally. Even though he hasn't seen them yet, here are his reviews of two primetime programs that are being telecast live tonight and tomorrow.
Here's the deal. If I wait until after these two shows are broadcast to talk about them, I won't be able to recommend one and warn you about the other. The one to watch is HBO's Paul Simon Live in Central Park concert, presented Thursday night. The one to avoid is Wednesday night's live syndicated special, The Elvis Files, which is all about whether Elvis Presley is really dead. I caught Simon's concert act when it came to Philadelphia, and it's one of the best I've ever seen. It's a wonderful set, showcasing Simon's continuing fascination with music from around the world. Like his reunion concert with Art Garfunkel a decade ago, this Central Park concert is bound to be a great show, and eventually a live album. So viewers and tapers should get ready. And keep your eye on the percussionist at Simon's far left. He's a wild man. As for the Elvis Files special, it comes from the same company that brought us The Mystery of Al Capone's Vault, and you remember what a royal ripoff that was. Bill Bixby hosts the show, which promises to examine handwriting samples, audio tapes, and other evidence that supposedly suggests that Elvis did not die 14 years ago this week. Yeah, right. If it turns out I've prejudged this show too harshly and done a bad thing by trashing it on instinct, I'll come back next week and apologize. But don't hold your breath. What's that? Elvis is calling on line two to complain? No, I'll take it. So, Elvis, you listen to Fresh Air? That's great. Why are you calling?
Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be so lonely I could die.
You are dead, Elvis. That's the whole thing.
Don't be cruel.
I don't mean to be, but it's hard to believe it's really you.
Why can't you see what you're doing to me? When you don't believe a word I say.
Well, if you are alive, where are you right now?
You know I can't be found. I sit home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone.
I'll be glad to. Just leave the number. When you say home, does that mean we can find you at Graceland?
You'll search, but you'll never find.
But if you're hiding, how come there are all these Elvis sightings over the years?
Sometimes I want to stay here, then again I want to leave.
So why don't you just leave Graceland for good and come out in the open?
Don't you know?
Okay, that explains it. One last question. What would you tell people who are thinking about watching the Elvis Files?
Don't.
Okay, thanks for calling, Elvis. I gotta go. I got Paul Simon on line one. Hi, Paul. We're just about out of time, but what do you think about all this?
I'm going to Graceland. And I may be obliged to defend every love, every ending, or maybe there's no obligations now. Maybe I'm a reason to believe we all will be received in Graceland.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Ellen Silva does our research. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. And we welcome our new intern, Tina Bennett. Hey, Paul, Elvis, you can give us a call on our listener hotline at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. I'm Artie Moscoane.
And I may be obliged to defend every love, every ending, or maybe there's no obligations now. Maybe I'm a reason to believe we all will be received in Graceland.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we meet food writer Edward Baer. His quarterly newsletter, The Art of Eating, doesn't have a big circulation, but it's the publication for food connoisseurs. Also, Stephen Pizzo on how to keep the banking crisis from happening again. That and more on the next edition of Fresh Air.